WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Alan Siegel is often called the word czar of the New York Times. He's overseen usage and style since 1977. Siegel has co-authored a new edition of the Times Manual of Style and Usage, the first new version since 1976. In addition to explaining the difference between who and whom, that and which, and other confusing usage questions, and explaining when to use commas and semicolons, the book discourages writers from overusing puns, insists that reporters quote their sources accurately without cleaning up the quotes, offers advice on how to attribute sources who want to remain anonymous, and suggests graceful approaches to gender-free language. I asked Siegel how the style book is used at the paper.
We have 1,100 people on our news staff. That's a pretty shocking number. And most of what you read in the morning's New York Times is written between about 9 o'clock in the evening and midnight. And that's a lot of decision-making about language made very, very quickly. And this enables them all to be on the same page and not have to run around to a whole bunch of different reference books or ask somebody, do we spell it T-E-N or 1-0? And the style book has always been a good place to find out is if something is slang, if it's too informal, for issues like who and whom, a quick place to check the answer, rather than leaf through grammar books. And sometimes you just want to know, do we capitalize president or lowercase it, or capitalize cardinal or lowercase it? All of these things are in the style book.
What are some of the biggest changes in the Times style book between when you first got to the Times and now?
Well, the most famous thing that happened this time is that we caught up with some social policy issues that really differ today from what they were 23 years ago when we did this book last. We didn't allow people to say Ms. because we thought it was a political statement back then. We didn't allow the term gay because it was considered also too political or too politically correct for our readership in the 1960s and 70s. We changed that sometime in the 1980s, but the book still carried all of these outdated prohibitions. And then we also tried to do to reflect the end of the Cold War. A lot of country names changed and terminology changed. And 23 years ago, when we did this book last, there was no internet, there was no web. Nobody knew what WWW meant. It probably didn't mean anything.
In the foreword to the new New York Times Manual of Style and Usage, you quote a few paragraphs of writing that you think were, you know, particularly excellent. Let me read one of those paragraphs. And this is from a journalist, Barry Burak, and he was writing this from Afghanistan. It says, with gunfire snapping in the wind and artillery blasts punctuating his sentences, the commander of the Taliban's frontline forces was in a boastful, triumphant mood today. He removed his artificial leg, sat comfortably on a blanket in his small brick fortress, and pointed a few hundred yards to the north, where, lodged in the foothills, was the last bastion of what was once grandly called the Northern Alliance. Quote, we are giving the enemy 10 days so that anybody who wants to get out can get out, said the commander Haji Mullah Abdus Sattar. Then, by the will of God, we will crush the life from anyone who remains behind. Now, what principles of writing are illustrated in that paragraph?
First of all, Barry paints a word picture. You may forget the Afghan political situation sooner or later. You won't forget the picture of a guy unstrapping his artificial leg to give the interview. The gunfire is snapping in the wind. He uses brisk, active verbs. He doesn't beat around the bush. We will crush the life. Granted, that's the quote he's using. It's not Barry himself. But he selects vivid, direct language, short words, nothing fancy.
Alan Siegel co-wrote the New York Times new manual of style and usage. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Alan Siegel, assistant managing editor of the New York Times. He has overseen style and usage there since 1977. He co-wrote the Times' new manual of style and usage. You have an interesting entry about slang in the Times' manual of style and usage. And I'm not sure you particularly, that you were the one who actually wrote this entry, but let me quote it anyways. It says, current slang can create the embarrassing spectacle of a grown-up who tries to pass for an adolescent. Some slang expressions will evolve into standard English. Others, like crunch for showdown and edgy, as in on the cutting edge, show up so relentlessly that they vault overnight from the novel to the hackneyed. I like that idea of current slang sounding like a grown-up trying to pass for an adolescent. What kind of slang do you find acceptable? What do you find objectionable? How do you draw that line?
When a writer has a good ear and he hears people using slang and he quotes it or even borrows it to create the scene that he or she witnessed, and it's fresh, the reader hasn't heard it lots of times that week or that month, that's good use of slang. When it's just prefabricated, when it makes the story sound like 20 or 30 other stories you've heard, and when it makes us sound like some other publication, then it's a false note. I happened to look up the expression poster boy the other day, and I found that in the last 30 days, the Times has called people poster boys for one thing or another 20 times. Now, clearly, that expression is in trouble.
Right. So is this the kind of thing that you do sometimes, is checking the computer how many times a certain expression has been used to see if it's crossed the line into cliché yet?
The computer helps us to verify our instincts. I discovered that we've suddenly started referring to people by this basketball figure, go-to guy, meaning the person you can trust in a pinch. And suddenly in the last week, everybody's been a go-to guy for one thing or another. The Prime Minister of Britain has an aide who is a go-to guy. Well, it's going to get stale very fast.
Let me get to an expression that's used a lot that you discourage in the style book, and that's inner city. What don't you like about inner city?
It's come to be a euphemism. It usually means black or black and poor, and it's imprecise. The inner city of Manhattan is the Upper East Side and the Upper West Side, and they're not any of the things that we usually talk about when we say inner city. But there's something worse about it. If you use a euphemism when what you really want to say is black and Latino and poor, it sounds as if you think there's something wrong with those expressions. Well, there's nothing wrong with being black or Latino or poor, and there's nothing wrong with talking about those traits in straightforward, direct language.
If what someone was trying to say was that the neighborhood was poor and it was predominantly African-American in population, how would you have them rewrite it without using inner city?
I'd have them say exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
Or very often when I see inner city in copy, I say, what do you mean? Let's just say what we mean.
Mm-hmm.
If inner city kids have been more exposed to this illness or this problem in school, let's say what kind of kids we mean.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about using African-American versus black or Native American versus Indian? How do you suggest your writers decide which is the more appropriate way to describe a group?
Well, we learned from our experience. A little while ago, you and I were talking about the years when the Times wouldn't use Ms. or gay, and that caused a fair amount of bitterness both outside the paper, ultimately, and inside the paper. And that recollection has made it very easy for us to deal with questions like Latino versus Hispanic or African American versus black. We simply encourage our writers to ask people how they'd like to be referred to, organizations, people we write about. There's nothing really wrong with using any of those expressions if they're comfortable in context.
Of course, like if you're talking about a large group of African Americans, some of the people in that group will prefer the word black and some of the people will prefer African American, so then you're kind of lost.
If we get lost, we count on our writers to use their judgment and find the way. What we have told our folks is let the writer make the choice. The writer's name is going to be on the story. The writer should be accountable for that kind of choice.
Now, one thing the New York Times hasn't budged on is you still can't just call somebody by their last name. It has to be Mr. Miller, not Miller, or, you know, Ms. Gross, not just Gross. And one way, you're probably familiar with this example, if you're talking about King Kong, Mr. Kong, a seven-story simian.
There are lots of, I'm happy to say that all of those myths are just that, myths.
Right.
There's one about the pop singer Meatloaf, who is alleged to have been called Mr. Loaf.
Right.
It didn't happen. We do use last names standing by themselves in our sports pages, of course, as everyone does, and in our magazine and in our Sunday Book Review, because those are more leisurely, different-sounding publications than the main part of the newspaper. But in the newspaper, we think there is a value to stopping and calling people Mr. or Ms. or Mrs. or Miss, if that's what they prefer, in exactly the same way that Congress people refer to each other as the distinguished representative from Georgia. Now, the speaker may or may not think that the representative from Georgia is particularly distinguished, but it's a courtesy that keeps the conversation at a level of civility, and we believe that in that very much in discussion of public issues.
I'm trying to remember how you deal with hip-hop performers like Chuck D. Does he become Mr. D?
We probably repeat the whole name all the time. No, we wouldn't call him Mr. D.
Right.
I guess the first rule of style is don't be ridiculous.
Uh-huh. Now, there's a lot of linguistic wars over things like pro-abortion or pro-choice, pro-life or anti-abortion. What advice do you have on that?
We try very hard to choose language that won't let any personal sentiment be visible or present in what we write. We don't say pro-choice because that's the term used by one of the sides in the debate. At the same time, we don't say pro-abortion because that's what the other side uses, or pro-life. We try to talk about abortion rights advocates, the abortion rights position, the anti-abortion position. We try to use language that neither side would contest. Now, I have to admit to you that we have come up against one piece of that debate that we don't know how to solve. The surgical procedure that is called by its critics partial birth abortion, there is simply no neutral way to say that. And if anybody has suggestions, please write to me at the New York Times.
What are some of the things you've come up with and then rejected?
Oh, there are all kinds of the technical expression for it is intact dilation and curettage, which is incomprehensible to most readers, and I'm told it isn't particularly precise anyway. And I don't remember what all the others are that we have tried to use, but we generally now use the expression partial birth abortion, but we say that it is what one side calls it. It's a very unsatisfactory solution.
My guest is Alan Siegel. He oversees style and usage at the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alan Siegel. He co-wrote the New York Times' new manual of style and usage. Can you give us a sense of what the line of editing is like? A reporter writes a story. How many editors read it before it's published? What are their different functions in the process of editing?
Well, at this point, if I don't tell you that much of the time there's too much editing, my boss will kill me, because Joe Lelyveld, the executive editor, has made a kind of crusade of convincing the staff that the best editing is the editing that involves one writer and one editor, one-stop shopping, everything that needs to get done gets done in one pass. And if the story is long enough and complicated enough and we need to go back at it again, then the same editor deals with the writer who has dealt with her or him first time round. Now, that doesn't always happen. But typically, a story written for the daily paper is assigned by one editor, or at least discussed by that editor with the reporter who's going to write it. When it's turned in, it's looked at by a second editor who is an assistant editor in the department, Metropolitan News or National News or Arts News. And then it goes to a copy editor when the assistant editor is satisfied that it's organized correctly, that it's about the right length, that there are no glaring omissions of facts. It goes to a copy editor whose role ought to be just to check spelling, grammar, and compliance with the style book, and then to write the headline. Now, of course, a good copy editor will catch omissions that others have made and ideally will go back and say to the supervising editor, hey, you forgot to tell us whether this legislation is likely to be voted by the other house. Does the president plan to sign it or not? That kind of thing can slip by the first line editor. But ideally, there's one substantive editor on every story and then a mechanical copy editing phase.
I want to talk to you about obscenity, vulgarity, and profanity. The style book says the Times writes unblushingly about sexual behavior, art censorship, science, health, crime, and similar subjects, opening its columns to any newsworthy detail, however disturbing, provided the approach is dignified and the vocabulary clinical rather than coarse. Tell us what your guidelines are for obscenity, vulgarity, profanity. If you're describing a rape, or you're describing a painting that is the subject of censorship, and the painting or the photograph is explicit in its sexuality.
We learned a lesson during the Mapplethorpe controversy about the sexually explicit homosexual photographs, in which we were describing them in ways that were so general and vague that readers told us they had no idea why there was a censorship issue. And we took away from that a sense that we really ought to talk in grown-up language about exactly which body parts were seen doing what. And I think we do that equally in a newsworthy rape story. Happily, we don't, as a newspaper, cover the amount of crime that would cause that to be on every page of the Metropolitan section every day. But when we cover a highly newsworthy sex crime, we're very explicit about the body parts and the specific activities that were mentioned at the trial.
How did the Times describe Mapplethorpe's work at the time of the controversy, and how would that have changed now?
I think toward the end of that, the development of that story, we talked very specifically about, I don't think you want to go into it on the radio, I think, but there were you know, objects placed in body openings that we had referred to in generalizations in some of our earlier stories, and we were very specific about it later on, because if it became a constitutional issue, and if readers are going to have an opinion about what the Constitution should allow and what it should prohibit, we think we owe them the basic textbook guidance about what the argument's about.
Now, you sometimes, the Times often runs corrections when there's been a misspelling, or a person has been called by the wrong name, or a photograph has been inaccurately identified. You also run editor's notes to rectify lapses of fairness, balance, or perspective. How do you decide when a piece is worthy of that kind of editor's note?
Very often, reporters or editors come over to me and say, "This is what happened in today's paper. Is it worth the correction?" And my answer to them is always, if you were writing that story now, knowing what you know now, would you do it that way? They always say, "No, of course not." Then I say, "Well, there's still time to fix it. At least fix the record, fix your conscience." And we put a correction in the paper or an editor's note.
A good example of that?
Yes, there was an editor's note just the other day where we had written about an interview with Betty Friedan, the feminist author, and she, in her new book, accuses her former husband of having physically abused her, and we described that at some length. I gather we did try to reach her husband for comment, and for some very peculiar reason, his telephone number, even though it was listed, wasn't available from directory assistance. This sounds like I can see you raising your eyebrows, but in fact, that's really what happened. And we never got his side of the story into the paper. And then he wrote us a letter asking that his side of the story get in the paper, and we edited the letter for length because it wasn't necessary to go on at the length that he did, or at least we didn't have space available to let him do that. And we put his view in the paper in the form of a letter, and as luck will have it, and sometimes these things just are luck, the next letter in the letters column, right under his, was another letter from another reader who believed the accusation against him, and so it had the effect of completely wiping out the equal time we had tried to give him. Well, he wrote to us and complained about that, and we ran an editor's note saying that, first of all, we should have tried harder and found a way to get his response into the same story as the accusation, and that, secondly, when we then ran a letter from him, we shouldn't have coupled it with another letter from a reader who didn't believe him. That made us look, at least to careful readers, as if we had a conscience in handling that story, rather than saying, you know, we own the printing press and to heck with you, Mac.
My guest is Alan Siegel, and he is he has overseen usage and style at the New York Times since 1977, and he's the co-author of the new New York Times Manual of Style and Usage. Color photos. When the New York Times added color photos on its front page, I think a lot of people felt, well, that's just it, because newspapers are supposed to have black and white photos, and color is what USA Today does. Color is what magazines in USA Today do. How do you think color photos have affected the paper one way or another, and has it given you a longer deadline? In other words, do you have to go to press sooner in order to print the color photos?
Well, if I'll take the last part first, no, we don't, because desktop publishing technology came along so quickly that we can print color photos now just about as quickly as we can print black and white. Occasionally, we may have to close the color portion of a page 15 or 20 minutes before we close the black and white, but we can keep the black and white open till the last minute. People used to say to me, as I was on one of the planning groups that worked out the conversion to color in the paper, people used to say, I don't want you to do that. You know, it's going to make the Times into a comic book. And I used to say, life happens in color. We give it to you in black and white. Can you name any place else in the newspaper where we knowingly give you less than we know, less than the whole truth? If we know that the president is married to a redhead, or the president is himself a redhead, and we just show you his hair in gray, can you think of any place else in the paper where we are systematically withholding information? It was a way of telling people more, of giving them more of what the scene looked like. Now, we knew that we were going to do it in a way that was conservative in design terms and responsible and consistent with the look of the paper as it had been all along. At this point, I should put in a plug for my colleague, Tom Bodkin, who is the design director and who really devoted years of his life to making sure that when we went to color, it would be with the same values and the same emphasis as the black and white that we did. But readers have been gratifyingly understanding about that, I think, because we occasionally get complaints about various things, but I know of almost no complaints about color as such.
How many newspapers a day do you read?
Four or five, the local New York ones, and I certainly try to do justice by the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal.
And why is it important to read those?
To know who's doing as well as we are, who maybe did something better, who has an idea that's worth expanding on in our own paper, and what kind, for that matter, who's following us, what kinds of things we've done that have had enough impact so that others felt that it was necessary to go back and do them the next day.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry. Thank you very much.
Alan Siegel co-wrote the New York Times New Manual of Style and Usage. Coming up, one of Kurt Weill's most neglected works is now on CD. This is Fresh Air.